This episode is sponsored by Jonas Paul Eyewear. They make the most stylish eyewear for kids on planet Earth. And this is where it gets really good, I think. With every purchase, you can actually help restore and maintain the eyesight of kids and families across the world through their Buy Sight, Give Sight program. If you've got a little one, or frankly, if you're in need of some stylish, smaller sized frames for yourself, check out jonaspauleyewear.com. The link will be in our show notes. You're listening to Plucking Up, a podcast that shares uninhibited conversations with celebrated authors, entrepreneurs, artists, and leaders about their pluck-ups. Our guests share their sometimes never-before-told mistakes, rejections, wrong turns, and the more difficult seasons of their lives and careers. But they also share with us how they moved on and up and through to keep creating and inspiring others to build lives of purpose, passion, and impact. I'm your lucky and plucky host, Liz Bohannon. Okay, so growing up, there were two things that my mother would never say no to. And this wasn't even just like a casual thing that we kind of all grew to know about her. Like, this was a stated rule in our home, which definitely had like limitations. And my mom was fine with telling us no about a lot of things, except for these two things. One was buying us books. So if we were out and we wanted to buy a book, she would just always get us books. She could never say no to books. And the other thing that she could never say no to was ice cream. I mean, this really probably explains a lot of who I am today, because I definitely inherited her love for books and ice cream. So imagine my utter, get it, utter delight when we found out that we were going to have Jenny Britton on the show today, because Jenny is a pioneer of the artisan ice cream movement, and she's also the founder of Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream. Oh yeah, she's also a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author, and she has won a James Beard Award. Okay, if you're not familiar, James Beard Award is like a big fancy deal in the culinary world. But Jenny is just whimsical and kind of quirky and eclectic. I mean, she did at one point pursue a career as an alien makeup artist, okay? So it's telling you something about her. Our conversation kind of went in some directions that I didn't necessarily expect. I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's definitely a lot of times where I went like, oh, wow, okay, didn't see that coming, right? And I'm just so grateful. I love, love, love hearing from people, most people on this show, that build these beautiful lives in vocations and careers, not out of these crystal clear strategic plans, but kind of just out of this like sense of experimentation and one step in front of another. Because I don't know about you, but that's way more reflective of my journey than the, you know, super chic, PR-worthy, straight and narrow path that oftentimes we hear about. So that being said, you know, Jenny makes people happy for a living. Her job is to sell ice cream. In fact, it kind of made me think of our general manager in Uganda. Her name is Agnes. She kind of runs the show over there for my company, Seiko Designs. And I remember talking to her, it was a couple years ago. I was going through a really difficult leadership challenge. And Aggie is just really wise. And she's somebody that I seek advice and counsel from. And I remember her looking at me. She was actually in the United States at the time, so we got to have this conversation in person. And I was just really struggling and feeling really demoralized. And she just looks at me and she's like, Liz, being a leader is really difficult, and sometimes not everybody's going to like you. And then she's like, if you want everybody to like you, just like go sell ice cream. And I've always kind of hung on to that as I've thought about my leadership journey. But then you have Jenny, who literally actually sells ice cream and makes people happy. But that isn't to say that she hasn't had her challenges along the way. Okay, anyway, go get some Jenny's ice cream after you listen to the show, because it's very good. It's just as good as this episode and as the co-creator and founder behind that delicious treat. All right, without further ado, Jenny Britton of Jenny's Ice Cream. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us here on the Plucking Up podcast. I'm really, really excited to learn more about your story.
I'm so happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Jenny story and take us back as far as you're willing to go, like into your childhood days. Who were you as a kid? What was your family like? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Peoria, Illinois. So no central way. Illinois.
I know where that is.
Do you really?
I spent like three years of my life living in Decatur, Illinois.
Yep.
Do you know where that is?
I sure do.
So there you go. So I would go with my older brother to his hockey tournaments in Peoria, Illinois.
Yep. We had a hockey team. I think it was called the Rivermen.
Okay. There you go.
Peoria Rivermen. Because we have a really gorgeous big river there. It's the Illinois River. It's really big and beautiful. I'm in Columbus, Ohio now. I moved here when I was 12 and we have two rivers here, but they're very small and kind of greenish, muddy. They're not the big, beautiful Illinois River that I'm used to. But I was raised by kind of alternative thinkers.
Oh,
deep into my family's both sides. My mother's parents were pretty traditional, little tiny house. You know, the mother stayed home. My grandmother was always there. Great garden, just a beautiful little heaven as a child for a grandmother and that environment. My other grandparents were a little different. My grandmother was an English teacher and an art teacher, very much a whirlwind of personality. At one point, my grandfather forbid her to go visit us in Germany. My parents were there because my father had been drafted into the army and my sister had been born and she wanted to go visit us in Germany. And he wouldn't allow her to go by herself. He was, you know, I guess afraid or something. So she sold his car and went anyway. And so this is my grandmother. She was just a force to be reckoned with. You did not say no to Enid, but you always had an adventure, always had fun. They had 10 acres of forest land that I went out to every other weekend, the one that I wasn't at my other grandparents' house. I spent a lot of time growing up with my grandparents. My parents were very young when they had us. I mean, my mother had just turned 20 2 weeks prior to having me to the day. So she is a very, very young mother. And so my grandparents became really important to them and also to me and my sister. But my grandparents, Eni and Jim, they had forest land. My grandfather was a Thoreau character. So he built a cabin in the woods. He was there every day. We had a lot of dogs and we made gardens. Everywhere the sun would shine through the trees, we would have gardens. My grandmother, as an artist, would always find materials to build things with, would research the Native American tribes that had gone through there over millennia, various tribes that had gone over there through that area over many millennia. And there are many. And we were finding arrowheads. And so we once built an actual authentic teepee, researched it for like 2 years.
Wow.
And built a real one that we could then actually take naps in and have a fire in. It was huge, which was amazing. So it was kind of the central point of the forest. But I got very deeply connected to the forest. She also made us meditate go off by ourselves for 2 hours every Saturday. So that we were there.
So like how old were you when you were doing that?
Between 7 and 12. So how I packed my bag was really important. You know, I always had a tape recorder and a sketchbook and a granola bar. And anyway, I had this tree that I would always sit under. And I believe 100% that there were gnomes living in the tree. It was probably original growth oak tree. Mm-hmm. And it was like 15 feet in diameter. I mean, it was huge. Mm-hmm. And so I sat there by that tree and I tried to sort of meld my energy with the tree. And I feel like that's been my grounding, I think, memory for my entire life. So through ups and downs and all of them that I've had in my life, that tree and that ability to like sync energy with nature has been something that I've used over and over and over again daily, but also in times of great, great stress.
Yeah.
So eventually my family falls apart and everybody's out of my life and all of that happens at like 15. So you go from to Columbus and everything falls apart and I'm on my own by 18, my mother very ill, my father's out of my life, and I'm just kind of on my own. But anyway, I'd already worked at an ice cream shop, and I was ready to have an ice cream shop, and I did it. There's a whole bunch more in that, but you know what I mean? It's like,
Okay, so you went from this kind of like kumbaya existence in the woods, it seems like very family-centered, to everything falls apart and pretty formative years, like late high school is when that kind of the wheels early high school, falling off.
Yeah, like as I was beginning high school.
Wow.
Yeah. And my mother was out of my life for a year. Then she came back in. And then my father was out of my life for 16 years.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it was a little crazy, crazy times for a kid. I also moved every year for some reason growing up. I mean, not because we moved. It wasn't that important, but just like across town. My family was just nomadic in that way. And so I never had like a community or a friend longer than a year. And that was also kind of goes into, I think, who I am and why things like community are so important to me now.
It's so interesting when I get to have these amazing conversations with amazing people that, yeah, it seems like there are two paths. Like either I experienced this and it was so good that I wanted to continue it, or a lot of times things being built out of a very distinct lack of, like, I saw that other people had this and I wanted it and I never had it. And so then I went out and I built it for myself. So it sounds like you're giving us some foreshadowing that lack of rootedness and community kind of played into a pretty deep desire for you to build that for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it very much did. I was in tune to that when it started to happen to me. And I started to identify, wow, this is beautiful. This is really interesting. And I hadn't had it before. Things like I was at the North Market, which is where I started my first company and my second company, both ice cream companies. And it's an indoor public market, like a farmer's market.
Yeah.
And the merchants there were very protective and, you know, they wanted to sort of care for everybody there. And that I just learned so much from them being almost nosy about what was going on, you know, but they just wanted me to, like, you know, stand, like, be healthy. Like, they, you know, at one point the butcher got really mad at me because I wouldn't put mats down to stand on all day because there's like concrete floor. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why does that person care so much about my back, you know? But anyway, there's just so many stories, just little ones like that. And I realized that, like, because when we all do well, we all do well, you know?
So you kind of just said, and then I was 18 and I was on my own and I had an ice cream shop.
I know. It's like, you know, how fast can we get to it? No, but I mean, I actually, like, I also, like, got a job as soon as I was able. I mean, I was babysitting by the time I was 10, 12 years old, and industriously. And then by the time I was 15, I went and got a worker's permit and I got a job in an ice cream shop. For some reason, I'd always known that I was going to work in an ice cream shop. I just, like, ice cream was really special to me. I loved the history around it. I just loved it. And in the Midwest, you know, you eat a lot of ice cream.
You do. It is. I was literally just last night talking to a friend who grew up here in the Northwest, where I live now here in Portland. Ice cream, just like, there's a couple, like, really trendy, super successful ice cream shops for sure. It doesn't seem like very built into the fabric of, like, culture, though, in a way that it was when I was growing up in the Midwest. For us, it was frozen custard. And it was like frozen custard. It was just built in after every soccer game, after everything. You go and you park in the parking lot and you pop open your trunk and you see people that you know. And, like, it was just like, it was very much so a part of our, like, family and regional identity in ways that I didn't know until I moved outside of that not every place revolves around a frozen treat.
I know. I mean, there are cities in America that don't have an ice cream shop, or, like, people who live there couldn't identify an ice cream shop in their city. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine being in a city where you can't identify several ice cream companies. You know, you go to the one for the hot fudge and the other one for this and the other one for soft serve and that, you know, and then when you're craving this, you go over there. I mean, like, you just know where your ice cream spot is and, like, where you go after the softball game versus, you know, where you might go after a date, you know?
So you started working in an ice cream shop. Tell us about going from being, like, you know, pretty standard, like, working in an ice cream shop job for a 15 or 16 year old to, like, maybe I want to own an ice cream shop.
Well, I was very entrepreneurial when I was a kid, and I always had businesses, and I always worked, you know, and tried to make money and tried to make things that people might want to buy. It was just like, because I had an artist grandmother, you know, we're always making something out of a lot of times found materials. And they were beautiful. I mean, things like, we would dye cattails, you know, the weed or whatever it is that grows in the ditch. And then we would dye it. We would dry it and dye it and make baskets out of them. And they were really beautiful. And so then I would sell those, but stuff like that. So very entrepreneurial, but I was not really thinking about ice cream yet. I mean, I loved the idea of being in an ice cream shop, working in an ice cream shop. I really loved the sort of heritage about it, the nostalgia around it. And the I loved the idea that everybody has their flavor in an ice cream shop. I just thought that was so cool that it's a place you can go where everybody gets defined. You know, everybody mm-hmm. gets to be themselves, and like, and they do that through flavor. Mm-hmm. But I then moved over and worked at a French bakery that opened right across the street. And it was just like so cool because it was a family owned French family, big family, boisterous, like lots of energy. The whole kitchen was French speaking, and it was just so cool. So I did think, well, maybe I should be a pastry chef. So at that point, I was starting to think that was like right at the end of high school for me. And then I decided to go to college. And I mean, there's a lot that happens in my life in a very short period of time because I really didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I could get into college. At one point, I was very serious about wanting to be a makeup artist, but like a monster makeup.
Oh, okay.
Like I wanted to, actually, you know what? I wanted to work for Star Trek.
Okay.
I wanted to work for Captain Picard. Next Generation started. I wanted to do alien makeup for that. So I actually went to esthetician school because I had to get a license in order to go to this LA school that I wanted to go to. That was a very real path for me until after I got out of that. I was like, I just don't really want to do that. I want to go to college. Like, I want to go learn about history. And so that was when I went to
So
Ohio
you
State.
Went to college out of more of a desire for like, I want a higher education than you did. It sounds like out of like, if I want to be able to live and make a living, I have to do this next thing.
Yeah, I you know, I don't know why. I think everybody else in my life was like, you know, trying to be an engineer, an attorney, you know, a doctor or whatever. And I was just like, I don't care. I genuinely don't care about any of that. I care about learning and I care about experience and I care about exploring. And I got into Ohio State, which I shouldn't have gotten into. I was a straight D student. In fact, I didn't get in. They said no, they rejected me, and I wrote them a letter and explained, like, my mother was anemic, she had a baby, like, you know, there's all this stuff going on, my father was out of my life. And they were like, yeah, okay, that's fine, you can come. So I went, and I was a straight A student at Ohio State. And it was amazing. So,
and what do you attribute that going from straight D's to straight A's?
Well, I, you know, when you're college and university is so different, especially the way I was doing it. So all of, you know, of course my counselors wanted me to stay on track. They wanted me to get all the prerequisites out of the way. I had no interest in any of those. Or frankly, looking back, I had no interest in graduating. So I was taking, you know, courses on like vampire folklore or upper level courses on the French Revolution. And I would just beg the professor to let me in. It's graduate level course, but like, you know, they didn't know what else it was. It doesn't matter. Get their signature and you can take it. Design. I was taking courses on like design history, various design classes, lots of fine arts and lots of art history. And I just bounced all around. I mean, I took plant biology because I thought it was so interesting and I was more interested in drawing the flowers than I was learning about that. So it was like, I could just bounce around. Ohio State is so huge that you really can find, I mean, there really are courses on vampire mythology or folklore, you know, just every once in a while, some crazy class will pop up like that. And it's just so cool.
It sounds like you were pretty free from the experience that I think a lot of people have going into college, where it's like, I have to do this thing because it's the logical thing and it's my safety thing. And then I just kind of step on this treadmill and I do what they tell me that they're going to do, because there's a lot of pressure, right? To like make good practical decisions and have a plan. And it sounds like you kind of rejected that and said, no, actually, I'm going to see this as an amazing opportunity to just learn what I want to learn and feed my curiosity. What do you attribute that, I would say, probably pretty minority mindset going into university too?
I don't exactly know. I mean, I think that it's from my grandmother, Enid. I think it's like my grandfather, who was very much a self-reliance kind of guy too, but always saying, go your own way. You know, like the idea that like, you know, you can do anything that you want. And that also came from my other grandmother. And I think to some extent, having that family in Peoria, Illinois, right? Where there wasn't anybody else to say that's not possible or, you know, I mean, it was just, I just grew up, I wouldn't say that I grew up with, I mean, for sure, my family were the kind of parents who just like hands off, right? You just go roam around all day, come back at night. If it's dark out for an hour, then my mom might come looking for us. But really, we were so free to explore. And then we were expected to explore. You know, my mother hated homework. She actually didn't like school either. And so she was always at odds with the teachers, which was really embarrassing for me as a very shy person going into school. Like the last thing I wanted is to show up without my homework done. But at the same time, like when I got home, my mother believed we should be outside. We should be doing things. We should be exploring, learning, and doing anything else but homework.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's, it's kind of like all of that.
I don't want to make too many generalizations, but of the folks that I have interviewed on this show, the trend of being from families that are either in some way alternative, right? Whether that's like Liz Gilbert grew up on a Christmas tree farm and her parents were like survivalists, or Sadie Lincoln, who grew up in a actual commune with like her mom and her like five aunts, these very like alternative existence. But then even for people who grew up in more, you know, traditional environments, their parents having a tendency to have more of a free range, hands-off parenting style is wildly consistent. Maybe it's just confirmation bias because I at least want, I think, to be more of that in my parenting. And so I'm looking for stories that confirm, like, yeah, I shouldn't be constantly entertaining my children. They should be exploring. I was just having a conversation with a friend. My kids are too young. They're not in school where they're doing homework yet, but I'm like already rebelling against it. Of like, you have my kid for 8 hours a day. You should be able to figure out how to do it all in that amount of time so that when they come home, they can play and they can explore and they can build and they can roam, and feeling myself being like really protective over that. So maybe I'm just looking for the stories that confirm where I want to go with my life and my parenting. But so I think it's pretty consistent.
Like statistics driven culture. And I think that it's really dangerous, really dangerous. I've seen how this works in our company too. Because if we want to tell a story through numbers, we can tell a story through numbers, right? Mm-hmm. We can find a way in to tell a story. But it is the anomalies. It is the like different stuff that can create, you know, somebody who's comfortable, I guess, doing that or, you know, there's just, it is in that sort of other side. You know, I mean, the fact is I walked out of Ohio State University. I never did get a degree there. And that is a very real path that anyone can take. I think it's important to learn how to think. I really think it's important to learn context and history, at least to a point. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's important to know how to act and to believe mm-hmm. in yourself and to trust yourself. And mm-hmm. even though you're going to fall down a million times, that's the point. That's how you advance. And so building that is more important than, especially now when we have all of information that's ever been known to a human, to yeah. the human existence on our phones. It, you know, just memorizing stuff at school is just not helpful to us.
Yeah. So you ended up going to college. Did you own an ice cream shop at 18 or you just worked at an ice cream shop at 18?
So no, that was the, then it was like, I mean, get into college. I mean, not at 18, but I was still trying to figure out my makeup life at that point. But I got into college, maybe 19, 20, did that for a few years. And that, this is what to me it's all about. It's, you know, and I think I knew this and I did know this and I know this now. I do the same thing now. When you like allow yourself the freedom to explore all the things that interest you, mm-hmm. You work hard at those things because it's so much fun. It's just mm-hmm. like you get into the flow, that creative flow, whether it's history or, you know, you're a mathematical person and you're just doing something that you're drawn to do. When you do those things that you're drawn to do, you just get into this place where like time doesn't matter. I mean, you can work all the time on those things. And that's what you want in life, right? You want to be in a career that does that for you. Right. And the only way you do that is by knowing what you want. And the only way you know what you want is by exploring.
Exploring.
And so Ohio State offered me that and other places too. And I just did that. And then I find, you know, kind of where things crossed over. I was also working at the French pastry shop, which I loved. I was actually at Ohio State. One of the things I was exploring was perfume. I had a friend who was adorable. He was French, Parisian. His name was Julian. And he was here as a grad student working in the chemistry department, working on like perfume, not perfume, but scented compounds. And so he would yeah. bring me these little vials of scent. And it was so romantic and so adorable. And I would go kind of like work in the lab with him, like see all this stuff. And I just realized that I probably should be doing this. He went back to Paris. And I was like, this is, I'm so connected to my sense of smell from the yeah. forest. And like, that I should be doing this. Because I didn't love like perfumes, but I thought, well, that's why I should be working in that industry, mm. right? Anyway, I got into scent and it kind of, everything crossed over for me. It was like art, fine arts, you know, storytelling, making something, you know, scent and flavor. And the idea that flavor is mostly scent, you know, using good ingredients, because his French family was like literally growing strawberries at their house and bringing them in and making tarts out of them sometimes in the summer. You know, so I was like learning about that. And then I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, I was making pastries and things like that at home. And one of the things I wanted to take what they were doing and make it American. So one of the things I started doing, of course, was ice cream. I was like, you know, I was doing cakes and like creme brulee. I was working with that and And then I just started making ice cream. So what I did was actually bought store-bought ice cream and I mixed a scent into it. So I had this like $400 Bulgarian rose oil. It was very beautiful. And I just put one drop into a vanilla ice cream. And that changed everything. It was like the sky opened up. So what happened was because I'd been studying all these different things, they came together for me because I had worked in an ice cream shop. I understood how people interact with ice cream and why. Because I had worked at the pastry shop, I understood that ice cream could be a lot better than it was, right? Where at the time, it was like junk food and candy, not about the actual ice cream. It was about all the stuff they put in it. Okay. Because I did art and I grew up with my grandmother, I knew that you can tell stories through anything, including color, scent, flavor. And so it all kind of came together for me. And I knew that there was a future in ice cream for me.
As the founder of a socially conscious company myself, I am always in search of brands that not only create amazing products, but also make a difference in people's lives. I could not be more thrilled to shout about Jonas Paul Eyewear truly from the rooftops. This company was started by Ben and Laura Harrison, who become dear friends of Ben and I. When their son Jonas was very unexpectedly born nearly blind at birth, they realized firsthand how limited the options for well-designed, stylish, and affordable frames for kids are. And they started this company for Jonas and for other kids like him. And it gets even better. With every pair that you buy, you help save and protect the sight of kids around the world through their Buy Sight, Give Sight program. Today until September 6th, you can save 20% off any purchase. So head over to jonaspauleyewear.com so that you can order their try at home kit to get your kids involved, or your kids can virtually try on their glasses and find their perfect pair. The link will be in our show notes.
Love that you probably could never have without actually being in the arena of exploring, taking the classes, having the friendship, doing the thing, working at the ice cream shop. It's like in hindsight, you can see how all of those pieces brought something alive in you that then kind of crossed over. But I think oftentimes in this thinking about like, what am I here for? What am I doing with my life? There's this sense and this pressure that you should be able to ideate it before you do it. That it's like, I should be able to go for a weekend retreat and I should be able to sit and think about my upbringing and my passion and what I'm good at. And I should be able to leave having done that, picked all these things out and then figuring out how they go together. And I just literally have never met somebody who's done that. Like 100% of people.
We think that like, okay, I'm going to figure this out by sitting here and
sitting here and thinking about it. Totally. It is
and
like,
you can't go do anything, anything that moves you, that inspires you, and you will work it out doing that. You
and
know
frankly,
I mean?
Go do something that you don't like and just be curious about why you don't like it. And that's remarkably helpful to walk away from that experience being like, here are the three things that I do not want to take forward with me. And even in that versus like, oh, I just failed. I did this thing and I thought I was going to like it. And then I didn't. And that was a waste of time. And it's like, you don't even have to do something that you love. You can just literally do anything and then pay attention to how it makes you feel, to whether or not it sparks something in you, to how time passes, you know, while you're interacting with that thing, and just stay curious.
So I always say that there is that like cycle of action, and it's for me, it's think, do, reflect. So you think, I'm going to go, you know, I don't know, today to the forest, then you do that and then you reflect. So everything that I kind of do, it's think, do, reflect, kind of a pattern of that. And, you know, the thinking is just like organizing and let's do this. It's going to be this. And then you do it without sort of all of the reflection that we try to do, you know? Then you act, and then you you sort of pause. How did that work? How did that make me feel? You know, what did I learn from that? How can it advance me so that you know the lessons that you did? And that I will do that. Like I actually still spend a lot of time in the forest. I go out there as much every week as I possibly can. But I do that just from doing that, or you know, maybe from working with a new vendor. You know what I mean? That we work with for 6 months. Okay, organize it, then just jump in and do it. And now let's reflect and see how it's going. Or if we want to launch a new campaign, let's do a, you know, think, do, reflect. It's just kind of a constant circle that we're on. You know?
Yeah, yeah, I love that. So tell us about the early days of starting the ice cream shop.
Well, I actually walked out of an art class to go start the shop, which is funny because a woman walked in. She was a beautiful model for the day. It was a figure drawing class, and they're 3 hours. And she was very tall and very thin, and I was just not good at drawing. I was always drawing the round people. I draw like on big, big paper. I always loved that. So I was just like, ugh, I can't do this. I cannot sit here for 3 hours and try to work out the angle of her hip bone. It was just, I knew I couldn't do it, and it was bothering me. So speaking of, you know, reflecting and knowing what you do well and or even stuff that you're not doing, I'm sitting there doing this and I'm just hating it. So I got up and walked around all of the students and walked out of the door and never went back. I left everything there, my entire portfolio, my sketchbook, all of my art supplies, because I knew I wasn't coming back. And I was a very poor kid back then. I didn't have parents giving me money. Like, I was living off of my own job and then, you know, grants and loans. And so leaving your art supplies there, which were probably $200 worth of art supplies, is a really big moment.
Yeah.
And I left. And a couple months later, I opened in our public market, the North Market. And, you know, I started learning from that moment. What I didn't know, which was literally everything. I didn't know how to make ice cream. I had been making it on these little machines. And I had found this, just by luck, a chef that had a Carpegiani, like an old French machine for sale for $1,000. These things are worth way more than that, even when they're old. And he dug it out of his basement and let me have it. And that was what I was making ice cream on. I mean, I went from this like Cuisinart machine to that. And I literally started learning. And then I found out that there was an ice cream department at Ohio State University. And I started hanging out
no
over there.
No way. An ice cream department.
So we're a land grant university. We have a massive ag school. And one of those schools is a dairy school, a dairy science school. And it's a fantastic dairy science school. And so I started just hanging out there. I wasn't a student there anymore. I would just go there. I made a couple of friends and professors and just started asking them all the questions that I had and how I can learn about things. They don't like to give you information. What they'll do is give you a book or say, yes, you're on the right path, or no, you're not. So then you go away and come back. But that was really great. So they have a whole ice cream thing over there, which is really great. And they have a yogurt thing and a sour cream thing and milk thing. I mean, they've got all the things.
My gosh, I would all be the in food. Heaven.
I just want to go hang out at a dairy, at a dairy university.
I know, right?
So do you have, when was the moment where you were like, shops open, doors open, ribbon cutting ceremony? What, how did you go from being in the, I'm learning and experimenting into like, this is a commercial activity that I'm doing?
I don't know how that really worked. I mean, I was 22 years old. It was 1996. You know, nobody was talking about how to launch a business. No one talked about venture capital. And, I mean, maybe in some of the business magazines and things like that, but it wasn't the same as what we have now. Mm-mm. First of all, I also didn't know or see a lot of other women doing this, which we see now, and it's so cool. So I was actually looking up to one person that was Bobbi Brown from Bobbi Brown Cosmetics. She was the one woman that I knew that was out doing, you know, something that she loved. And I just was like, if Ben and Jerry's can do this, I can too. The North Market is a 400 square foot place. For a few hundred bucks a month, I can start a business. So I just started. It just opened one day. There was not like a launch, you know, it was just like one day we were open. And it was pretty fun. We had a little bit of a line and it was fine. The business was fine. You know what I mean? I kept making a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was doing. What I was doing was I was still thinking like an artist. So I was making whatever flavors I wanted to every day. So I'd go around the market, you know, whatever was there, I would turn it into ice cream. And over time, I would sort of fall in love with certain flavors. Like salty caramel was a flavor that I opened with. It was big deal flavor and a couple other ones. And, you know, I would kind of make it whenever I wanted to. But people liked it just as much as I did. And so people would come back for it and I wouldn't have it. So the idea, you know, if I had like a business model I was trying to create, it was like, you know, that there was this ice cream artiste, you know, who was making all these different wild flavors every day, and you were going to be like entertained by this person and this, you know, you're going to have these moments of discovery at the counter every single day. And they were going to be influenced by the market or art history or pop culture or whatever. But it really doesn't work that way. And I didn't learn that until actually after I closed. You know, entrepreneurs love to be like, well, you know, people weren't ready for us yet, or, you know, whatever, like our customers just didn't get it, blah, blah, blah. Actually, it's always your fault. You know what I mean? Because entrepreneurship is a two-way conversation. You have to be listening and churning it back in. And it was like, I closed the business, went to this coffee shop one Saturday, And they were out of this thing. The only reason I was even there was for this orange scone that they had. And I was like going to spend my entire Saturday there. It was just like, I got up to the counter, waited in the long line. They were like, yeah, we're out of that. So what would you like? And I was like, actually, I don't want anything else. I just want that. And they were like, okay, bye.
See ya.
And I was like, oh my gosh. So I turned around, I walked out of the door. And I remember thinking as I walked out, how disappointed I was. Yeah. And that I had done that to every customer at Scream. It was called Scream Ice Cream. Okay. Every customer that came in looking for salty caramel. And they were like several a day, you know, and it didn't occur to me that like,
I would have been
you
one of
make
them,
it?
By the way. I'm obsessed. My favorite ice cream shop in town. It's like, I have to go to this shop and I have to get the salted caramel and I will be devastated. Never happened to me, but I can't imagine if I showed up and they didn't have
my salted
caramel.
I'm like that too. We're all like that. Like if I was going to go to Scream Ice Cream as a customer, that's the one I would have ordered. And it was so dumb to not have thought that for the 4 years I was in existence. As much as a service person as I think I am, to not have had that cross my mind. But, you know, it just takes a while sometimes. You know, these kind of reflections just take a while to sink in.
The balance between having a vision as an entrepreneur or an artist or, frankly, just like a human, and having integrity and having a vision and having something that you want to see come to life in the world, that's like one part of it, right? Is like, if you run around and you're 100% focused on other people's feedback, I don't think you'll ever get anywhere. You will just be like a chicken with their head cut off, trying to like make stuff that pleases everybody, that doesn't have any like personality, any integrity, any like brand consistency. It's like, no. You can't rest everything on people's feedback. But then also there is this danger of like, well, my vision of who I am and what this product is so important that I'm not going to listen. I'm like feedback. I'm going to keep myself from hearing feedback. And frankly, I don't even think that this is just limited to being an entrepreneur. Like, I frankly think that this is just being a good, grounded human, right? Like seeing people that are just living their entire lives being complete people pleasers is a very common experience, right? Of just like, I literally just try to make everybody else happy. And I find that those people end up sad and empty and resentful because they don't know who they are and what they're doing in the world. Then there's a whole other crop of people that I feel like are like, F everybody. They don't get what you're doing. It's their problem. Like, and I'm also kind of like, that might be a little extreme because like how you affect other people in the world and having like being able to receive feedback without necessarily throwing everything out, but saying like, how can I hold these two things together? I have this vision of being an ice cream artisan. I also want to listen to my customers and want to incorporate that feedback and that customer-centric experience into this vision that I have, and melding the two, I think is a really, really magical sweet spot.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think there is a balance of that. If you're not pursuing and exploring the things that make you happy, that you find that sort of drive you, I mean, I don't know that you can be happy. And at the same time, if you're not able to know that you're making someone else happy. I mean, I just think that we're social. I mean, we are social beings. Like, to know that you can help to make your community better, that you can also that by listening, you can make everything that you do better. And then what is that? Is it so it just serves you? No, that's not fun. It's so that it can serve others too. I always say that my whole story is about asking for help, which it is in many ways. I just constantly just ask people for help. Because I didn't have a family to fall back. I didn't have a safety net. I just had to constantly be like, hey, you want to do this with me? Hey, you want to come over with me? Be like, so you have to be, even at Scream, even though I got that part of it wrong, you know, I still was getting a lot of input and help from other people. And like, and that became really just, it really became my story. And I now say that it's fellowship. You know, people ask me sometimes what my favorite business book is, and I like to joke. It's not really a joke, though, because I don't really read business books, but I like to joke that it's the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yes.
Really, if you know nothing else about building a company except that it's this idea that you have your idea, you have your passions that you bring, and you're a good listener, and you're able to sort of meld those two, and everything else is about building fellowship. It's about knowing what you do really well, and then about thinking that your company, the word means community, it means fellowship, that fellowship, who are you putting into the fellowship?
Yeah.
You know, and that includes your customers and your suppliers and all the people who are helping you get the ring to Mordor, right? And everyone is totally unique and they all have to have a unique place on there and not a lot of overlap because otherwise you make someone else disposable, right? On that fellowship. So I think of that to this day, you know, is the fellowship healthy? You know?
Yep.
and you're constantly using the very limited resources to do a lot. But it's that fellowship that, you know, a bunch of different people come together and together we make something greater than the sum of its parts. And that's the company. You know, it's the ecosystem. It's we take the money from our customers and we spread it out over a whole bunch of other people so that they can do the things that they want to do. And we can all kind of do this together. And it literally is its own world.
So tell us, was there a moment, I mean, you just shared one with Scream where it was kind of like a little learning moment, probably should have been creating something a little bit more reliable for my customers and not disappointing them. But as you have grown Jenny's from, I'm guessing you started out with, you know, one shop into the massive brand that it's been, can you share with us a pluck up, a moment along the way that you look back on and you're just like, ooh, man, that felt really bad in the moment. That was a mistake, a wrong turn, a rejection. And tell us a little bit about that moment in your story.
I mean, I have so many, as you can tell. I'm a start small and build entrepreneur. My entire life is about falling down, learning, and getting back up, right? So many, and it happens constantly. There are massive ones. I mean, we've had a recall in our company, which was terrible, but we did the right thing. We found a pint with Listeria in it in 2015. And before we even got all the tests back for everything else, we knew it was the right decision to recall everything. Didn't find it in the rest of our ice creams, which was really great. But in doing that recall anyway, we knew that we had prevented an outbreak. And it takes a long time to get through all of that stuff. So we were able to move on, you know, relatively quickly. That was still a very, very tough, not just year, but many years for me, because you don't get to tell your story when you're in that with the FDA. I understand it's like all legal when it's all that super tight legal stuff, you have to be really careful. So you don't have a voice.
Yeah.
And so people make up stuff if they don't know it. So that was really hard. That was hard personally on me, even though I think that, you know, if you're in the food business, you're going to, you know, it's food. It comes from earth. And we do everything we can, of course, to avoid that. And we learned a lot. We became literally who we are now because of that really horrible time. And actually, you know, I will say, just so that you know, the company was flatlined, like it was dead. And we, over time,
from the outbreak situation,
you know, because of how expensive it was, we had made decisions recalling everything. We then didn't have any ice cream to sell. We had to close our kitchen. Like it was, we had an entire summer with no sales and also no money. And so we were, that was it. That was it. And we came together, this fellowship. I mean, literally, when I think of fellowship, I'm thinking of Aragorn and I'm thinking of swords and I'm thinking of dirty battles that, like, you are just fighting for every inch. And that was what we did. And we fought our way back over years. But it was also, now looking back, like, it made me to the, I mean, it is me, right? Mm. But I'll give you a funnier one, too, because this one's the one that I just think is so like me. And that is that one year I had decided, this is maybe 2014, I had decided that, like, not everybody's happy during the holidays. Not everybody wants, you know, dancing elves and joy everywhere. And, like, you know, some people feel like there's all sorts of reasons why we're not always happy at the holidays. And I don't know, I must have had been having a tough holiday or something like that. So I decided that our entire theme was going to be like this dark holiday. We were going to kind of go the other direction, you know?
Yeah.
We were going to, like, evoke, like, the weight of time. So we're like, some of the flavors are like cumin and honey and butterscotch. So it's like this, like, fertile crescent kind of area, like thousands of years, you know, beautiful flavors. Cedarwood was one of the flavors, and vanilla, actually one of the most popular flavors that we did that year. They were beautiful, but the decor in our stores was like, I mean, it kind of looked like a dungeon. It was like, like paper chains, like you might make with, like, glitter paper, but we made them with, like, black and craft brown.
Uh-huh.
It was tragic, actually, tragically dumb, to be honest. I just thought we were doing this cool thing. Some of the photography is pretty cool. One of the flavors was black forest cake, and it was like super dark chocolate with cake in it and, like, deep dark cherries. But in Chagrin Falls, this beautiful little town outside of Cleveland up by the lake in Ohio, the ladies of the town actually were like, yeah, no, no. They brought us Christmas trees. They brought us, like, spirit and, like, put it up in our windows. They were not having the whole thing. And I remember just thinking, my first thought, as anybody's would be, was like, is like annoyance. You know what I mean? We're trying to say something here, ladies.
Totally.
And literally the second thing was, oh shit, they're right. You know, because we all need this holiday, whether we like it or not, whether the joy thing works for us this year or not. it is a moment in the year that it's a landmark kind of moment in the year. Mm-hmm. We know what to do when we see these things around us. We know what to do. We're reflecting on the year. We're moving forward. It's a marks time. And without those things, actually, you don't feel safe. Mm. And Andy Warhol, I remember studying him in college in art history and like studying, you know, the Campbell soup cans and some of the mm-hmm. sort of pop art that he was doing with, you know, these everyday images. And that was the whole point of those. And I remember even linking that, being like, that's the whole point, is like when all of that stuff disappears, you lose your sense of safety, even if we don't love some of it sometimes. You know what I mean? And I just thought that was... it was just such a pivotal learning experience for me. And it goes back to also, you know, it's that two-way conversation. You know, we're not here to solve every problem. I can't do everything, but you know, I think we are here to like make people happy.
So funny. I deeply identify with that, like, desire. I can just go, I can so rabbit trail from like an ideological perspective. And I just have such deep, like that sense of like, we're going to make a statement and we're thinking about this in a way that's different than other people. And we're going to do something. We're going to create a space for people. You know, we're a happy ice cream business at the happiest time of year and we're going dark.
Yes. Yes. And
And I don't know if you're anything like me, but when you're in the ideating phase, you're just like, oh yeah, this is good. This is so good. It's so cool. Unique. It's going to be so cool. And then you launch it out into the world and it's just like chirp, chirp. There's a reason that people don't do that, because it's not working or it's not what people are actually asking
can't, you
for.
Really, and I think can't mess with the holidays. You can do something. So I found sort of the time when you can like, you know, really go wild is like after the holidays when it's still winter and people do want to come out for it. They want to come out and see some weird stuff or some whatever. But like spring, you can't mess with too much either, or even summer. I mean, you can do a couple of things here and there, but you know, you got to have something recognizable, because people like ice cream, you know, it's their thing. They're ready for ice cream. They've just been through winter. They need strawberry. Don't put balsamic in the strawberry. I know 4 people love that, but don't do it because everybody else doesn't. Just make the just get really good strawberries and make them perfect in the ice cream, you know?
Yeah. So what, talk to us a little bit about when you have the moment where you're like, okay, maybe I just need to run a happy ice cream shop at the holidays. Can you talk to us a little bit about, did you feel any like shame, embarrassment? Like what was kind of your process from going from this is a brilliant idea and we're innovating and we're creating this really unique human experience for people and making a statement to like, I probably just need to do the thing that everybody else does around the holidays. Like, talk to us about a little bit about your emotional process through that time.
I mean, there was definitely some shame, but I'm pretty good with shame. And I will tell you that every night, at least, and sometimes several times a day, I'm very good at forgiving myself. I learned a long time ago, sometime in high school. I mean, I was very shy, very quiet. And I was just ruminating and like spiraling each night about, you know, whatever somebody said during the day or whatever.
Yeah.
And I realized that like, if I don't forgive myself and let it go, I will never advance. And I always wanted to be the kind of person who was able to do things and not be super shy and not be super scared and not be, you know, so I was like, if I don't do that, I'm never going to get anywhere. So for me, that I'm actually really good at being like fight hard, fight hard, fight hard. And then realize I'm wrong. It's like, okay, I'm wrong. You're right. You know, when it flips for me and I let it go and I can feel it. Sometimes I have to pause, walk away, look in the mirror, sit at my desk or whatever, but I can let it flow out of my head. I have two things. When I'm trying to get rid of pain in meditation, I let it flow out of my toes. It pops out. I do like a filter. And when I'm trying to get rid of shame, it goes out of my head. I don't know why. It's just done it. So it's like a filter that will just pop it out. And
okay,
I let
sorry,
it just
what,
go.
What goes out of your toes?
Pain. So if I have physical pain, I can, a headache, for instance, that like nothing can take care of and I just need to like sit very quietly, then I can sort of do a filter down my body and like out my toes and it like just will get rid of pain temporarily. But yeah, so I just kind of let it go. But
and what do you, what's the truth that you replace it with? Like you followed up with like, you're not a failure. You're not an idiot. You're not an embarrassment for doing this thing.
Now you know.
What is the, so the narrative is I'm smarter now today than I was yesterday because now I know, because I tried the thing.
Yeah. And also once you do that and you see how people react to you, people react to you like you're the smartest, coolest, warmest, most amazing person in the entire world over and over again. When you say, when you're like, when you fight hard for your customers, you're fighting for this, you're fighting for this, and then you realize you're wrong and you stop and you shift and pivot immediately. I got it now. You're right. People are like, they trust you. You know, it's immediate. You know, suddenly, you know, it's not like people are like, yeah, I told you so. No, it's the opposite. Everybody around you is like, oh, really? You know, and then it's like, okay. And then you're like, yeah, let's go. I get it. You
that
know?
Is so interesting. So it's like you would attribute part of this of who less about like, oh, I just am innately good at doing this, and more of like, well, I tried it and the feedback loop is very positive. So I take note of that. And there is this kind of like external affirmation that comes. And I think you're totally right. It's very arresting when you encounter somebody who's willing to change their mind. I think specifically right now in this moment in culture, we've gotten so far from that where it's like we're all digging in our heels harder and harder and harder and becoming more extreme to, you know, defend our ideas or our position or whatever, you know, group we want to belong to. That when you are in the middle of a conversation and you stop and you say, I've never thought about it like that. It is a very arresting thing. Or I find apologizing. I was this long story short, I just had an encounter with a customer service person that enraged me. He was like not listening to me, acting like I was an idiot. And I got pretty angry. And I was just like, you know, because sometimes I feel like you can't be heard. I hate this, but I'm like, you kind of have to be the squeaky wheel. So I was being a squeaky wheel and I'm not conflict averse at all. So it doesn't take me a lot to get there. And then after it got resolved and I like had kind of calmed down, I was like, that's not the person that I want to be. It is how I ended up fixing the problem. But I just looked at the guy, his name was Chris. And I was like, Chris, listen. And you could tell at this point, he's like really uncomfortable and just, you know, probably wants me to leave. And I'm like, hey, Chris, I'm really sorry for raising my voice at you. And he was like, you could just tell he was like, did not know what to do with me. And then I made it worse. I was just like, it's okay. It was really frustrating. You know, I get it. He was, you know, whatever. And I was like, no, I know. It was very frustrating. And I didn't appreciate how I was being treated. However, like, Chris, you're an amazing human in the world that deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. And I get that you were just trying to do your job and I was advocating for myself. But if I made you feel anything less than that, I'm really sorry. And I was like, Chris, will you forgive me? And this is like, you know, just like a random customer service dude. And Jenny, you just like would have thought, I mean, like he just was completely stunned. And I think was like, am I on a hidden camera? Like, what's happening right now? But I think that there is just something, you stop the cycle of just like shame and blame. I'm fighting for my own. And like, say, I'm human and you're human. And like, let's acknowledge the humanity in one another. And then we can move forward. That can really change the tone and change the kind of like spirit of an environment. And so I love that you're allowing yourself to be positively influenced by that feedback cycle.
Well, we're all negatively influenced by it constantly because, I mean, where does shame come from? It comes from what we think other people think about us.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, all of our self-worth comes from what we think other people think about us, which is such a weird thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's not what they actually think. It's what we think that they think.
Totally.
And so when you're just aware of that and aware of those relationships, and honestly, to be in business and to be an entrepreneur, you have to be a really good negotiator. And negotiations are about coming to the middle always and about seeing good in every side. You have to be able to do that. If you can't do that, you're not a good negotiator. I've never met somebody who's a good negotiator who is stuck in there, who like digs their heels in and stuck in their ways. I mean, you can't do that. And apologizing is, as you might guess, one of my top, you know, skills. I apologize really well. And I always, you know, do what you did, which is acknowledge what I did wrong and what I need to be working on in order so that it doesn't happen again. And that will be like, you know what? I was putting a lot of pressure on you and it was Saturday and you were planning a graduation party and I didn't realize that and I'm sorry. And from now, you know, I will now, you know, I just want to acknowledge why I know that it was harmful to them.
Yeah.
And then also from now on, I'm going to ask what you're up to and make sure it's okay with you before I engage you on a Saturday, you know, or whatever, you know, like,
yeah,
I constantly.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love your point about so much of our shame being about our creative fiction that we're writing in our heads about, I'm assuming this is what you will think about me if I admit this, if I ask for forgiveness, if I call attention to what I did wrong.
You're
so afraid.
You're going to think I'm weak. Totally. But you know what makes you look so strong? When you can stand in front of people and say, okay, you're right. You're the strongest person any of those people have ever met at that moment. You know that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
That is not easy to do. And none of the, half the time I'm with people, like they don't want it. They're not going to do that.
Totally. And I think it's such a gift because it gives permission. When you go first, it gives permission for other people to do the same. To be like, absolutely. Oh, maybe next time I'm wrong, instead of digging in my heels or hiding in my shame, I can say, oh, yep, that was a pluck up. I made a mistake. I want to make it right. And when we show up in our vulnerability, in our authenticity, because it is hard, I think other people see that and they acknowledge that. And that makes them go, it can create a new path for people to go, oh, maybe I could do that. Maybe I could show up with that because I don't hate her or I don't think she's an idiot for doing that. So maybe people won't hate me or won't think I'm an idiot if I show up in my authenticity and vulnerability in that way.
The most important thing you can do as a leader. I mean, I think it's the definition of leadership, you know, just being vulnerable, showing, and as you say, because I think it's absolutely true, giving permission. In doing so, you give permission for the people who work with you to do the same, because people will treat you different as a leader. You have to show them it's okay for them to come to the table as their whole self and be vulnerable, make mistakes, take risks, you know, at the table and in their work. And you have to show that. You can't just say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I love that. So good. I feel like we could keep going, but I'm so grateful for who knew that an ice cream entrepreneur, I got my first shipment of Jenny's a couple months ago. Someone sent it to me as a gift and there was so much of it. And I ended up taking a bunch of it to my son's school, to the teachers. And I was like, if you want to quickly become the favorite parent, and I shouldn't be the favorite parent here. You just take them Jenny's ice cream and everything will be great. Everything will be great. So
ice
thanks
cream
for giving
makes everything
me some.
Better. That's what we always say. You know, from the Midwest, that is absolutely true.
It is so true. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you and follow you and read your stuff?
Well, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm very open about my life. It's Jenny Britton Bauer on Instagram. And of course, Jenny's ice creams on Instagram as well. That's just the best place, or jennys.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. What a great conversation.
All right. Well, of course, I hoped you loved today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really helps us out. We really appreciate it. This podcast was made possible in part by my amazing producers at Human Group Media. So for updates and announcements about the show, you can follow me on Instagram at Liz Bohannon or Human Group at Human Group Media or at Human Media on Twitter. We would love to connect with you guys. We love hearing from our listeners and building this community. So feel free to reach out. All right, that's all, you guys. We'll catch you again in the next episode. Until then, stay plucky.